Thank you for downloading this programme from BBC Radio 4. For more information, visit bbc.co.uk/radio4.
A quintessentially British scene. Saturday afternoon in the local, watching the rugby. And a moment of respectful hush for the national anthem. The Welsh national anthem, that is. This is the Mochindee in Cardiff, and Wales are about to give England a serious kicking in the Six Nations. So it's arguably not the best moment to ask people to wrap themselves in the Union Jack and tearfully embrace their Britishness.
In the event of a war or some major catastrophe, I probably would choose to be British. On any other day, I am a proud Welshman. I would probably die for my nation. I would probably have to think twice if I had to die for Britain.
I am Welsh and I am European. I never feel British at all.
We're a small nation, we haven't got much, so I believe in what I am. I'm not British, I'm Welsh.
Well, speaking for myself, I do feel proud to be British. But that's not the only component of my identity. My father's Maltese, and I'm a Londoner as much as a Briton. The United Kingdom has always been a map of multiple identities. How much truer that is today in an era of mass immigration and labour mobility. More and more of us are hybrids. On Britain's streets, the duality that the drinkers in the Welsh pub spoke about is not the exception, but the norm.
I'm from England, so I'm English rather than British.
I'm an Asian, but British.
Cockney Spaniard, not an Englishman, a Spaniard.
I would say I was Northern Irish.
I'm a Muslim living in Britain.
Definitely British, but definitely Irish.
See, I am here, and I'm a British. I am a Geordie, and I'm a British.
So I suppose I see myself as British, but I've got a lot of Jewish in me as well.
Well, I'm born over here, so you're classed as English and British, aren't you? There's no foreign in me, I know that for a fact.
She makes it sound like a medical condition. The tests came back and they were negative. But it's almost a platitude to say that Britain has always been diverse, modern Britain especially so. So here's the challenge. Amid this thicket of multiple identities, can we find a Britishness for our times? A shared national identity that's strong enough to mark out what we all have in common, or should have in common, but not so restrictive that it ends up being distinctly un-British, too literal-minded, explicit and confining, in a country that's always preferred the unspoken, the tolerant and the flexible. That's what we'll be asking in this programme. They're questions that have preoccupied the Prime Minister for many years, and although I edit The Spectator, a right-of-centre magazine, it's an interest I share with him. He believes the new century requires a new emphasis upon national identity.
Globalisation is something that is here to stay. It's a fact. It's not something that you can wish away even if you wanted to, and I don't. But it actually forces, I think, countries to be far more explicit about what they are as nations. Everybody wants to be rooted. Everybody wants to feel a sense of belonging. I'm a great supporter of the European Union, but in every European country, there is a very strong sense of people in Poland being Polish and France being French and in Britain being British.
But how strong? I agree with the Prime Minister that a series of pressures have built up and that we do need a stronger sense of who we are as a nation. I part company with him when he says that the answer lies in something as nebulous as values, and I'm not alone.
I think there's too much jargon about values, and I don't think the values ultimately, I don't think they're enough to bind a people together, because they're very easily disposable and changeable.
Cardinal Cormac Murphy O'Connor is the leader of Roman Catholics in England and Wales. For his community, of course, the question of multiple identities and how to resolve their competing claims is as old as the Protestant Reformation. Small wonder, then, that the Cardinal is a faith leader whose views on Britishness Brown has been especially keen to hear.
Values are something that could also be idiosyncratic, it seems to me. Your values are your ideas, things that you live by, which are not necessarily shared by everybody. Virtues are different. Virtues on which people live a civilised sort of life. So virtues are there to enable the human person to grow. And grow not just individually, but within a community.
Because as presently framed, the quest for Britishness is fundamentally based on the quest for values. So how would you propose that we shift the ground to a quest to locate it in virtues?
Well, I think, first of all, you need to be reinstated in Britain something of its heritage. And its heritage is definitely a Christian heritage. I think that maybe the way in which the Christian heritage, Christian truth is depicted, which makes room for everyone, even makes room for those who are not Christian at all, I think it could be, it should be, the most attractive way of creating this kind of British society.
How do you expect the Muslim teenager living in East London to access this Christian British heritage you're talking about? What does that, I mean, in practice, what does that actually mean to him or her?
Well, it means that there must be very good dialogue, friendship between Christians and Muslims.
But can you see how the prescription you're proposing could appear to make some people less British than others? That the atheist or the Muslim could feel, well, hang on, you know, aren't I less British than these people who tap in more directly to this Christian heritage of which the Cardinal is speaking?
No, I don't think so, because I think we have to dialogue and have core values, if you like, or core truths with the Muslims, the people of other faiths. I'd say the same with the atheist. I think we've got to dialogue with the atheist too. I would in no way ignore the values, the goods, the truths that the atheist people bring to this diary, or indeed to the benefit of this country.
Impressive as the Cardinal's arguments are, I'm not persuaded that Christian heritage has a central role to play in this 21st century quest to find common ground. More than ever, I think, faith is seen as a private matter for consenting adults, rather than a determinant of national identity. Indeed, this is one of the reasons that some people are nervous about the growth of Islam in Britain, a religion that tends to be more assertive than modern Christian denominations and makes no clear distinction between private conscience and public space.
Being British is speaking the language, adhering to all policies of being in Britain, not trying to change policies by becoming a Muslim nation, Christian country.
This is Hena in Derbyshire, a small market town between Nottingham and Derby and just a few miles from where D.H. Lawrence was born. Once a Labour stronghold, at the last local elections, the BNP won two of the town's three seats on the council. I'm used to the metropolitan arguments you hear in the middle-class part of East London where I live, and I'm often the one making them. But here in Hena, you hear very different views and a tone of anxiety a million miles from the chattering classes.
Nowadays, it's not really about being British, is it? Because we've got all the different languages and whatnot in the country, taking all different jobs and getting all British people out on the sidelines, aren't they?
I mean, here in Hena, it's a small town, like Leicester, Birmingham, and yeah, I've got your multi-races more, haven't you? Whereas the small places seem to stay more or less same, don't they? You don't like change, really.
I'm nearly 70, and when I was 20, you hardly saw a coloured person. Or if you heard a foreign language, you know, it was quite a surprise. But now, you want to stand on any street corner, or in Derby or Nottingham, and you'll hear different languages all over.
If you act like you're English, you'll get treated like you're English. If you, you know, you go around with a turban on and, you know, Turkish restaurant over there, they act English. But then you get other foreigners come over and they want us to act like what they are, you know. They're wearing the burqas and all this lot, and I don't think they should be doing it. You don't go to Iraq and see an English church. You know, the bells ringing on a Sunday, they just wouldn't have that. But we have to put up with mosques and synagogues. But then again, I've got note against Jews or... I'm not racist.
Actually, there are more than 40 Christian churches in Baghdad alone, but let's not be pedantic. What you can see here are two very different ways of defining what makes us who we are. Steve Reicher is a social psychologist at the University of St Andrews. Here he is explaining what separates these two forms of identity.
Very often people draw a distinction between what they call an ethnic and a civic definition of national identity. An ethnic definition is one based upon descent. Why am I Scottish? I'm Scottish because I come of Scottish parents who themselves were born of Scottish parents back into the mist of time. So it's backward looking in that it roots our identity in the past. The civic definition is much more about I am here now, I am committed in the future to this country, I devote myself to this country.
Not surprisingly, this is the definition of national identity that politicians prefer. It's broad, inclusive and voter-friendly. But what about the rest of us? How do we judge who is one of us?
What we tend to find is that in some conditions, particularly when what people are saying is public and accountable, then people do buy, if you like, that inclusive definition. Often, however, when they're not accountable and in private, there still is evidence that on the whole, and I don't want to take this too far, but on the whole, the ethnic definition has slightly more purchase than the civic definition.
This would be no surprise to the Olivier Award-winning playwright Bola Abaje.
I could wholeheartedly say I'm a Londoner, but then I wouldn't say that I'm British. I'd say I was British African. I don't think that I feel British enough, but I do feel like a Londoner.
Abaije was born in Britain and grew up in Hastings, Nigeria, and Peckham. Her work explores the identity crises of young black Britons.
I've got a friend, she was born here, her parents were born here. Even in school, when you have the debates about where are you from, it was like, Anita, where are you from? Here. Where's your mum from? She's from here. No, but where is your grandparents from? Oh, they're from Jamaica. Well, then you're Jamaican then. Why are you saying you're British? Everybody always wanted to trace those steps. People would always turn around and say, yeah, but you're black, so you can't be from here. It's hard to want to be a part of something if you feel that you don't feel accepted into it.
This is a common story and evidence enough that there is much work to do, that the favourite British solution of muddling through is no longer doing the trick. The irony is that more than any European nation, Britain is multicultural. I'm perhaps the last person in Britain who still uses the word multicultural in a non-pejorative way. I mean multiculturalism simply as a statement of fact, not a left-wing doctrine. Britain has always been a porous, diverse society, and to me, that's one of its many glories as a nation. We abhor uniformity and homogeneity. So yes, Britain is a multicultural country. But how do we get people to buy into that? Is a big part of the problem the language we use?
Nationality is something that I don't really relate to. I look at the whole world as a kind of palette from which you draw various experiences and various kind of influences, and from which you can paint your own pictures and your own perceptions of things.
The musician Nitin Sawhney is one of the most exciting artists in Britain today, brilliantly eclectic and nimble in his use of creative sources. For me, his concerts dramatise modern urban Britain as successfully as anything in contemporary culture, but he himself resists anything too national.
The problem I have, where British does actually have associations, which a lot of Asian people, for instance, are uncomfortable with, whether we like it or not. You know, there's the association with the Union Jack from the flag-waving skinheads who used to have the Union Jack T-shirts and attack Asians. I mean, we have those associations. They're very hard to lose. But I also think the term British, inevitably, it leads to parochial thinking. And I think, you know, the problem is right now we have to think globally. We have to think in terms of humanity. And so rather than think in terms of how we redefine a word that is outmoded and parochial, why not look for other ways of thinking, full stop?
Which is what an artist does almost by definition. A policymaker, in contrast, has to deal with all the competing ways of thinking that already exist. Transnational loyalties, religious identities, ethnic consciousness, local community affiliation. What do these mean for Britishness? Does being British have to take precedence over other allegiances if it's to mean anything? I've come to Leicester, a city so diverse that demographers calculate that by 2020, ethnic minorities will be the majority, or put another way, there will be no ethnic majority.
I feel well integrated into this country, and I am Muslim as well as British. So I can't differentiate between that, really.
You don't think there's a choice? There might come a moment where you had to choose one over the other.
If it comes to that, I mean, religion I would set apart as a religion, whereas Britishness is more like towards your country, isn't it?
Yeah. Do you think it's right for the government to get involved in things like polygamy and the way people get married and that sort of thing?
In my opinion, you know, it's basically one's beliefs, and they shouldn't interfere in that, I don't think.
The proverbial man on the street speaking. Next stop is a beauty salon for a cup of tea with its owner, Rosina Kiddi, and her sister, Rehana Brideson, both Muslims of Indian origin, who moved to Britain from Africa.
There's nothing preventing us as a Muslim to live in a land which isn't governed by Sharia. Religiously speaking, as long as we follow the law of this land and it's not contradict the laws of Islam, it is fine.
If it does contradict the laws of Islam, then what do you do then?
Well, personally, I've not felt that there is any law that prevents me from practicing my religion. In fact, I find that Britain is a very tolerant society compared to many other European countries like France. I would not be able to go to work wearing my hijab in France. So I feel as though there are no regulations or no laws that prevent me.
I suppose you could say that Britain is quite is quite tolerant of things that Islam doesn't necessarily approve of. So, for instance, homosexuality is legal and, you know, not regarded by a lot of people as anything odd, and yet Islam frowns upon it. What about that?
There shouldn't be a problem with that. I mean, in Islam, homosexuality is forbidden, but that does not prevent me or any other Muslim from treating a homosexual as a human being. It's just that, personally, our view is religiously that what they're doing is wrong. Same as if you were going to go and go out for a pint. I'm saying that's forbidden, that's illegal, but I'm not going to treat you any differently for going to the pub and having a pint. You know, and it's a matter of coexisting that way. I mean, the problem, I think...
So it's about what you think inside rather than how you act. In other words,
right.
So you wouldn't feel that's
wrong.
It wouldn't change the way you behaved.
No, it shouldn't.
I think everybody should be entitled to an opinion if they don't like somebody. As long as it doesn't cause the other person harm and it is simply a feeling, then I think they should be allowed to just step away and not have anything to do with it. I worry that if we try and legislate a lot, people aren't going to be able to think for themselves.
What would you feel if a gay man came into the salon and asked for a treatment?
We do cater for men, and I would say yes. And actually, I do have a gay client.
Some of my best clients are gay, in other words, but don't try and force me to be liberal by legislation. Just when I think I'm getting my head round it all, this angry Leicester mechanic throws a spanner in the works.
I was born here. I've been in an English school and everything else. Even though my parents are from India, it's lost its culture.
Britain has?
Yeah, it's just lost it totally. You're losing your pubs, you're losing your Sunday carberies. It's more European. You don't see English people around, you see more European.
When you say European, do you mean people from France and Italy or Eastern Europe?
Poles, Kurds, Turks, Romanians, Kosovans, the lot.
So what you actually think is that Britain used to be something that was pretty clear to identify.
Yeah.
And now it's losing that because of Europe, which is a really...
The floodgates they've opened up.
Yeah. Because, of course, you know, if the BNP were here, they would say what would, the real problem was the people that came in from the Commonwealth countries and so on. But what's interesting about what you're saying is it's not the problem at all. The problem is the people that have come in through the immigration controls being dropped because of Europe.
Yeah. Me being Asian, I still voted for the BNP.
I did. Even though they would, if they were in power, they would try and repatriate you to a country you weren't born in. But, I mean, you're British. So how can you vote for a party that would send you back to a country that you don't come from?
I wasn't born there, but still, you should have your own land. And it's like back home. When I go back to my parents' land, it's like India is India. Pakistan is Pakistan. Your country, your land.
I left Leicester with a sense of some confusion amongst its citizens about what Britishness is, some anger, but a tentative readiness to accept a core of agreed behaviour and social practice, non-negotiable norms, if you like. This, to me, is the heart of the matter. There must be a core of norms that no minority right or global claim can trump. Lists of values are not enough. We have to take positions, contentious by their nature, about what is and what is not permissible. Regarding, say, the status of women, the treatment of gay people, the respect accorded to those who serve their country. And we should not be afraid to link standards of behaviour to patriotism, especially when educating the young. I don't think all or even most of this need involve lawmaking, but it has to be explicitly and fearlessly expressed in our political, policy and educational discourse. A series of lines in the sand, from Land's End to John O'Groats. For some participants in the debate, however, a written constitution is a necessary building block.
I would hope it's not too late for a written constitution.
The historian Linda Colley has been closely identified with the debate on Britishness since her highly influential book Britons was published in 1992, and Gordon Brown is one of many senior politicians who have consulted her.
Written constitutions historically have usually been the result of new states being created after decolonisation or old states having been defeated in war, wanting to reconstruct themselves around new icons. It's very difficult in times of peace for people to sit down and say, OK, how can we reinvent ourselves? I don't think it's impossible, but it is challenging.
Challenging in all the wrong ways, argues Michael Gove, the Shadow School Secretary and a member of David Cameron's inner circle.
One of the things that I worry about is that the approach that seems to be taken with a grand statement about what Britishness is, a statement of values, is that will automatically become contested. It's in the nature of British identity that it's very, very difficult to sum up in a pompous and sonorous declaration.
So just to be clear, if there is a Conservative government, no written constitution, no statement of values.
David Cameron isn't a fan of written constitutions, and he certainly doesn't think that we would need a statement of values for people to understand Britishness. David and the modern Conservative Party's understanding of Britishness reflects the fact Britain's changed a lot in the last 25 years, and it's going to change, I think, even more in the next 25. So therefore, any attempt to codify British values risks fossilising them.
Which is a fair objection. But that leaves open the question of how best to transmit the norms of a rejuvenated Britishness. If not a statement of values, then what? Well, how's this for inspiration?
My fellow citizens, I stand here today humbled by the task before us, grateful for the trust you've bestowed, mindful of the sacrifices borne by our ancestors.
Once every 4 years in the United States, an American president gets up and delivers essentially a non-political speech reminding everyone of the American story.
Sir Jonathan Sacks is chief rabbi of the largest British strand of Orthodox Jewry.
We don't have inaugural addresses. We don't actually have moments where we celebrate Britishness. We don't have enough ritual. Look at the way a religious tradition inculcates values. It doesn't do so by setting them out on a single sheet of A4 paper to be committed to memory by kids in school. It does, though, through rituals and festivals and special days. We have under-ritualized our national life.
I think the chief rabbi is spot on here, and as he's pointed out elsewhere, new ceremonial need not be contrived and can swiftly command our emotions if it feels authentic. National Holocaust Memorial Day has shown that since 2001. But ritual alone is only part of what the chief rabbi calls society building. Narrative history provides the foundation stones. Here's Michael Gove again.
I think over the last 30 years, there's been a shift in education overall, which has happened particularly in the teaching of history, away from emphasising the importance of narrative and knowledge and chronology, and towards an emphasis on acquiring skills. Now, that means that the overwhelming majority of people who pass through school studying history do not develop a sense of the coherent narrative of this country's development. And the sense that we've produced a generation, several generations, who do not know our island story isn't just a hunch that I, as a Conservative politician, have. It's what every academic study, every Ofsted inspection of the teaching of history confirms. And I think we're missing something big here.
History is about the microcosmic worlds of streets and neighbourhoods, of course, as well as kings and queens and great battles. I'm standing on Brick Lane in the East End, an area where I once lived. It's long been a laboratory for the British story, home to successive waves of migrants over the centuries, Huguenots, Jews and Bengalis. And where I'm standing, I can see street signs in many languages. Now, living here, you certainly see how a new Britishness could work, how coexistence operates in practice. But you also see the fault lines, and particularly the fundamental problem of communication. Today there are at least 90 different languages spoken in the borough. It's good that translators are so readily available to people in distress, especially in hospitals and doctor's surgeries. But far too little is done actively to steer migrant communities towards learning English. In a society as diverse as this, the teaching of English should be a basic civil right, and the learning of English should be a basic civic duty.
Where we came from, the rituals we observe, how we communicate. But what about our religious beliefs or absence of beliefs? Surely the time has come in a multi-faith, secular society for the disestablishment of the Church of England. Well, not so fast. Here's the Archbishop of Canterbury, Dr. Rowan Williams, making a case for the status quo of such cunning that it's hard not to applaud.
The odd thing is that a great many people outside the Christian fold in Britain, secularists, Jews, Muslims, will say, actually, we're quite grateful for the established church. It says that there are some things to which the state is answerable, and that's good. It also says that there's an unavoidable level of engagement with the stranger and the person with different views, which needs something to hold it together. So it has surprised me, to be honest, experiencing the established church in a new way and coming from the background of a disestablished church, to see how positively that's seen by some people as part of a guarantor that in British society, A, there will be a place for religious discourse and religious argument without panic, and B, that it's assumed that the state itself is prepared to be challenged.
Because the interesting thing is that the most of the motor for disestablishment is coming from those who argue from a pluralist perspective. Mm. What's so fascinating about what you're saying is that actually there is a very contemporary argument for the established church, not just one of tradition, but actually one that's located in the 21st century, which is that this can assist with the negotiations that necessarily happen within a plural society.
One of the great dangers, I think, in broadly modern politics is the rationalist trend, which says there is one way and one way only of being a society. You may have your private views, but you practice them behind locked doors. The establishment says, well, here is a religious model of society coexisting with non-religious models. It's an argument we need. It helps both of us. It helps the secular society at large not to take itself too much for granted. And that, I think, is a deeply contemporary point where you do have a position where people imagine there is one and only one way of running a society. It can be rationally defined and thoroughly policed. I think you have a very illiberal future.
Got that? According to the Archbishop, we need to preserve the state's religious dimension to prevent the state from becoming illiberal and monolithic. Now more than ever, he argues. A bit too ingenious to be true, perhaps. But Dr. Williams is right to suggest that disestablishment should not be the priority of those seeking to redefine and entrench Britishness in the early 21st century. I doubt that the Muslims of Leicester would feel any more or less British if the Queen were to cease to be Supreme Governor of the Church of England. If we are to get anywhere in this debate, two historic errors have to be set aside. First, there's the old-fashioned notion that diversity is a threat to Britishness. Quite the opposite. Diversity is its very essence. Uniformity is not British. Those who hanker for the Britain of the 50s waste their time and ours. Second, the implications of this need to be recognised with equal rigour. For too long, there's been a squeamishness about declaring non-negotiable norms for fear of offending one group or another. But having a core of agreed practices, rituals, language, and historical knowledge is not a threat to a diverse society. It's a prerequisite for cohesion and peaceful coexistence. In a century whose stresses and strains will be sharp, where the economic future is uncertain, where clashes of identity around the world are getting worse rather than better, we need a confident new strategy for getting along with one another. And what, after all, could be more British than that?
If you've enjoyed this programme, you might like to try other Radio 4 podcasts, from Friday Night Comedy and Daily Drama from the Archers to a range of news, discussions and documentaries. For a full list of available podcasts, visit bbc.co.uk/radio4.